From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. UN peacekeeping forces were created to keep peace between countries. But now in places like Somalia and Bosnia, peacekeeping forces are in the middle of civil war. On today's Fresh Air, we look at the changing mission of the peacekeeping forces and why their rules of engagement may have to be changed. We'll talk with former UN Undersecretary General Brian Urquhart. He directed peacekeeping forces in the Middle East and Cyprus. He served with the UN for 40 years. Also today, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie, The Firm. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton announced a forest management plan today for the Pacific Northwest that's being criticized by both the timber industry and environmentalists. The administration proposed a reduced timber harvest, some protection of old-growth trees, and assistance for displaced workers. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The administration announced a plan today that the president said he knew wouldn't entirely please anyone. These decisions may not make anybody happy, he said, but the virtue of the plan is that besides being fair and balanced, it's not the status quo. The status quo is a court-imposed ban on logging on federal lands in the Pacific Northwest, the result of a harvest that bumped up against the Endangered Species Act. Today's announced plan will allow some timber harvest, 1.2 billion board feet a year, sets aside some areas for limited logging, and establishes buffer strips around streams and watersheds. It will be presented to a district court in Washington state as evidence that the federal government is now taking steps to protect endangered species in the region. Not surprisingly, the industry says the harvest level set by the plan is too low, and environmentalists are demanding more protection. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
ABC Television reported this evening that the Justice Department has decided to take a controversial Egyptian cleric into custody, but will not charge him in connection with the alleged New York bombing plot. Suspects in the plot and in the World Trade Center bombing have been identified as followers of Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, and federal officials have said the Sheikh knew of the alleged plot. Officials said earlier this week that the Sheikh was worth more to them if he were not in custody, since he and his followers can be kept under surveillance. Three more suspects in the alleged terrorist bomb plot had bail hearings in New York City today. The defense for one of the suspects is arguing the defendants were entrapped by a government informer. NPR's Maria Hinojosa has more.
According to prosecutors, Clement Rodney Hampton L., the only African-American charged in the case, could potentially flee the area and pose a threat to society if allowed to be freed on bail. They asked the judge to detain Hampton L. without bond, citing evidence that Hampton L. had said in conversations with the government informant that he could provide him with explosives. But in building their case for entrapment, the defense attorney called six witnesses who said Hampton L. was a peace-loving Muslim who had never spoken of violence. In the end, the judge postponed the bail hearing for Hampton L. until tomorrow and asked for transcripts of the specific conversations between Hampton L. and the government informant before he could make a decision on bail. In New York, this is Maria Hinojosa.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 5.5 points to close at 3,510.5. Advances edged declines in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 281 million shares. This is NPR News. Congress sent President Clinton a stripped-down version of his jobs bill today. The bill contains money for summer jobs, small business loans, and other programs the president asked for earlier this year in a much larger bill that was defeated by a Republican filibuster. The original package called for more than $16 billion in what the president said would be a quick boost for the economy. The administration claimed its original bill would have created 500,000 jobs. No estimate was given for the package that passed today. A major civil rights organization signed an agreement today with the parent company of the Denny's restaurant chain. Black customers in several states have accused the restaurants of racial discrimination. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People and Flagstar Corporation plan to cooperate during the next 7 years on an effort to improve the racial climate at Denny's and at other restaurant chains operated by the company. In recent months, groups and individuals have charged that Denny's employees have delayed or denied service to African Americans. At least two groups of customers are suing the chain, and a federal judge in California has ordered Denny's restaurants in that state to end alleged discrimination at every level. Flagstar's agreement with the NAACP, announced today in Baltimore, is an attempt to do that nationwide. The agreement reflects previous pacts between the NAACP and other American corporations, in which the civil rights organization monitors hiring and promotion, training, outside contracting, and other company functions, with an eye toward racial fairness. I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
Police in San Francisco say that several people have been wounded by a gunman who opened fire on the 34th floor of a building in the downtown business district. The building's been surrounded by heavily armed SWAT teams, and a negotiator has been called to the scene. Witnesses said the man walked into a law office and opened fire. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The UN has peacekeeping missions in 13 countries, and in some of those places, like Bosnia and Somalia, there is no peace to keep. We wanted someone to help us understand how the peacekeeping forces got into the predicament they find themselves in today. So we called on the man who has been nicknamed Mr. Peacekeeper, Brian Urquhart. Urquhart was involved with the UN at its inception, serving as personal assistant to the executive secretary of the Preparatory Commission. He was personal assistant to the first secretary general of the UN and later became undersecretary general for special political affairs. His main functions were directing the peacekeeping forces in the Middle East and Cyprus. He retired from the UN in 1986 and has since been a scholar in residence at the Ford Foundation. Brian Urquhart says the nature of conflicts and the mission of many peacekeeping forces have changed from the early days of the forces.
Well, this is a very basic change. The UN was set up in 1945 to deal with conflicts between states and disputes between states, and that's what the member governments signed up to do. Now, very partly due to the great efficacy of the media in motivating public opinion, the UN is constantly called on as a kind of world emergency service and fire brigade to deal with situations which are not conflicts between states. They're mostly conflicts within the boundaries of states or former states like Yugoslavia. This is not at all the situation which the UN was set up to deal with. I think it's very important it should learn how to deal with it, because I think that's going to be the nature of most conflicts in the next few years at any rate. But this has all come as something of a surprise to the Security Council, I think, and I think it's very important that they take the time from their very, very busy schedule of dealing with crises to consider what basic changes are necessary to carry out this kind of duty, and it's not a small problem.
Do you have any suggestions about what kinds of changes should be made?
Well, I've suggested, being fortunately by now very old and irresponsible, that the UN, first of all, must have the capacity to deploy forces very rapidly, which may use the necessary degree of force to inhibit the spread of violence at the beginning of one of these conflicts. I think that that has been the great trouble in the last two or three years, that the delay in reacting has been very, very great, 3 or 6 months in some cases, by which time the situation is completely out of control. And the peacekeepers, who are not allowed to use their arms except in self-defense, have been regarded with contempt by the fighters on the ground, who by the time they've got there have been in the middle of a full-scale battle. I think that's got to be dealt with. Either the UN doesn't get into that kind of situation, or it gets in time with sufficient strength to actually control the situation. And that will mean having standby forces, either volunteer forces from member states, or, I have suggested, actually recruiting a volunteer UN force. That force would, of course, be under the control of the Security Council, but it would be immediately available for whatever purposes the Council wants it to address. Now, there are all sorts of problems with that: legal, rules of engagement, expense, and goodness knows what. But the truth of the matter is that the expense of UN peacekeeping is a pittance by comparison with the appalling expense in life, in human misery, and in money, and so on, that a war constitutes. And I think we've got to look at this as an investment in a slightly better future, where fewer people are displaced and fewer people lose their lives.
So in the model you're talking about, UN forces could be sent in at the beginning of a civil war to try to prevent the war from progressing.
Yes, they'd have to have very well-defined objectives For example, they would have might have an objective of ensuring compliance with a ceasefire agreement, something that doesn't exist at the minute, or ensuring and protecting the delivery of the necessary humanitarian relief, or ensuring guaranteeing certain minority populations against gross abuses and violations of their human rights. There are all sorts of things that you can think of. It'd have to be a very, very clearly defined mandate, and I don't see any reason why that's not possible. It's very difficult to do when a conflict is raging. You have to get in at the beginning, when the first involvement of the UN takes place. At the moment, there is, I think, a very grave danger that the Security Council, which in recent years, to everybody's great surprise, has been able to agree on virtually all the problems that come before it, will simply become a resolution-producing machine with very little effect on the situation on the ground. I mean, the Council has now adopted over 40 resolutions on Bosnia. They cannot be said to have had a tremendous effect on the disaster that is taking place in that area. So that I mean, it does seem to me that one's got to take a look at the plus side, which is that the UN is politically now a body which is capable of agreement on important problems, and give it the tools to do the job.
Well, do you think right now the UN peacekeeping forces are doomed to be ineffective?
No, I think peacekeeping is an extremely valuable technique, provided the conditions which are essential for it are present. The trouble is that it's got into a whole series of situations where those conditions are not present, and I think that the Security Council is going to have to develop new means of doing this. And in fact, to some extent, it is belatedly doing that. For example, in Somalia, the forces are allowed to use force for their purposes, which they're not allowed to do. It's under Chapter 7 of the Charter, which is the enforcement chapter. Up to now, peacekeeping forces have been restricted to using force in the last resort in self-defense, which has been, in my view, a very important factor of their success in dealing with conflicts between governments. But it's not so good when you're trying to deal with General Idid or some partisan militia in Bosnia.
Well, in Somalia, after the attack on Pakistani peacekeeping forces, there was a retaliatory bombing attack on Idid's militia.
Yes, that's right.
An attack led by the UN peacekeeping forces. I mean, that was quite a change for UN peacekeeping forces.
Yes, it is. But as I said, that operation is quite difficult, different in nature anyway, because it's under Chapter 7 of the Charter, which is the enforcement chapter. The UN has sort of drifted into a different mode of trying to deal with these things. And I think up to a point, that's all right. What I think is necessary for the UN to consider is what it needs to have available to intervene quickly at a point in these different conflicts where you can really make some difference at a relatively small cost. The trouble it recently has been that the UN has got in very late in Somalia or in Bosnia, after the crisis has already become very violent and has disintegrated to some extent. And that is a very difficult thing to deal with.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Brian Urquhart, former Undersecretary General of the United Nations. Yesterday, the UN Security Council voted to keep peacekeeping forces in Croatia for another 3 months. That's a very short period of time to renew for, only 3 months. What's your critique of how the UN peacekeeping forces have operated in the former Yugoslavia?
I don't criticize the way the peacekeeping forces have operated. I think that their courage and their restraint is beyond praise. What I do think needs to be looked at is the nature of the mandate they have been given in relation to the situation they're trying to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that in either Croatia or particularly in Bosnia that the conditions were ever present for the classical tradition type of peacekeeping operation, which had been very successful in a number of conflicts between actual governments, between states. I don't believe the conditions for that kind of operation ever existed, and I think that's what needs to be looked at.
Do you think that the UN peacekeeping forces shouldn't have gone in?
I don't know about that. I think that the pressure to do something made it inevitable that the Council would reach for the only tool it actually had available, which was peacekeeping. But I think that a far more careful analysis of the problems they were going to have to deal with and what they were going to need to really deal with them would have been very advisable. I mean, the truth is that the conditions for peacekeeping, which is a non-violent operation, are a ceasefire in place and guarantees of cooperation from the people who've been fighting each other. Now, none of that existed in Bosnia, and only to a rather minor extent in Croatia. And I think that that has put the peacekeeping forces in an impossible position. And incidentally, it's inhibited any other form of action, because now the objection to doing anything else in Bosnia or in Croatia is that it will endanger the lives of the peacekeeping forces who are already there. That is the British and French objection, for example, to lifting the arms embargo for the Muslims of Bosnia.
Are you saying that until there's a plan for peacekeeping forces that is meant to operate during a civil war as opposed to a war between two states, that it's pointless for UN peacekeeping forces to go in because they have rules of engagement that don't apply to the situation?
Well, they have modified those rules of engagement in Somalia belatedly, and we'll see how that works. I think there needs to be very urgently a very serious, high-level public debate among the governments who have to decide these things in the Security Council, and also, incidentally, are called on now to produce the forces, as to how they are going to cope with a series of situations which are not at all what the UN was set up to cope with. I think it's a very urgent matter. And it seems to me that that until that is done, and until there's a sort of rethinking of the way the UN not only gets involved in situations, but actually comports itself in those situations, that we're going to go on muddling through. Now, I think it's certainly much better to have put peacekeeping forces in let's say, Bosnia or Croatia, than to do absolutely nothing. I think the thing that is not often pointed out is that the combined efforts of the humanitarian agencies, like the High Commissioner for Refugees and the peacekeeping forces, have unquestionably saved thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of lives. But the truth is they haven't managed to deal with the problem, and that is what the public and the press and the, sees and points out, rightly. And I think that the way the UN gets involved has to be really seriously rethought. The Secretary General, Boutros Ghali, has tried to start this process with a report he produced last year called An Agenda for Peace, which makes a number of proposals which are very relevant to this kind of situation and which have yet to be taken up seriously. And in particular, he's made a proposal about peace enforcement actions, which is a little bit like the one I've been suggesting, of volunteer rapid deployment forces. But that has not been taken up in any serious way, as far as I know, by governments yet. And I think the sooner they start taking it up, the better.
There's a new challenge now to the United Nations in the former Yugoslavia. Serb and Croat nationalist forces say they'll start charging tolls to UN convoys passing through, and the UN says it won't pay. What do you think is going to happen there? I mean, what are the UN's options there?
Well, I think that, I don't know why it happened, but I think that the early decision to allow any old checkpoint on any old road to stop and search UN vehicles was a great mistake. We never allowed that in traditional peacekeeping operations, and I don't know why it was allowed in Yugoslavia, because it was the thin end of the wedge. And I suppose there's only a very small step from having the right to search and delay convoys to charging tolls on them, which seems to me to be totally outrageous. But I don't know how that's going to be dealt with. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that if the UN and all its members get involved in very, very difficult situations, which are for the benefit of the vast number of the people involved in them, that the least that can be expected is some kind of support, and not a hostile policy, which is now being adopted by various partisans in former Yugoslavia. I think that the UN has got to be much tougher about that.
Brian Urquhart is my guest, former Under Secretary General of the United Nations. We're going to take a short break and then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Brian Urquhart, former Under Secretary General of the United Nations. We're talking about the peacekeeping forces. I'd love it if you could give us some background about how the peacekeeping forces were formed and how they operate. Let's start with some of the guidelines for behavior. As you've explained, the peacekeeping forces are supposed to only fire if fired upon, with the exception of in Somalia, where they're operating under some new guidelines now. What are the other guidelines for behavior?
Well, I think it's important to bear in mind that people didn't say, peacekeeping, we must organize to carry this out. Peacekeeping developed in a kind of more or less ad hoc way from a series of actual situations, starting in Palestine in 1948 with the First Arab-Israeli War, when it was perfectly clear that you couldn't begin to try to keep a truce going without impartial military observers to report and to deal with both sides and to patch up the truce whenever it showed signs of failing. And that is how we got into peacekeeping. And we got in simultaneously in Kashmir with another group of observers, which is still there, incidentally, also in 1948. And then in the Suez Crisis of 1956, where the armies of Israel, France, and the United Kingdom invaded Egypt on a number of pretexts, there was a really very serious situation, a real threat to world peace, because there were threats of involvement from the Soviet Union and so on. And that was too serious a situation to deal with just with unarmed military observers, which we'd used before. And so an actual peacekeeping force was organized, called the United Nations Emergency Force, which was the pioneer peacekeeping operation. And it's interesting that everybody said it wouldn't work, at least almost everyone, except for the people who were organizing it. As they say about any new involvement of the UN in anything. And it turned out to be a great success, in fact, rather too much of a success for its own good. This was a force which started off getting the British and French armies out of the Suez Canal area. It was the pretext on which they left. And then it was moved up to the border between Israel and Egypt in the Sinai Desert and created a kind of a buffer zone on that border, which up to that point had been the bloodiest border in the Middle East. And it maintained almost perfect peace on that border for 10 years, which nobody initially thought it could do. It was based on the cooperation of the Egyptians. Though the Israelis, it has to be noted, did not allow it to be stationed in Israel and weren't very cooperative, though they benefited a great deal from it. It was based on non-use of force, except in the last resort in self-defense. That is to say that its members could not use their weapons except to defend themselves in the last resort. And it was based on the voluntary provision of troops by the member countries who were asked to provide them.
As you've pointed out, in the peacekeeping forces, you're asking soldiers, against all tradition and training, to take part in nonviolent operations. In the early days of the peacekeeping forces, how did you prepare soldiers for that?
Well, we didn't, is the answer, because it was so urgent to get them in, because everybody was afraid that the Russians were going to weigh in, that they had virtually no training at all. And we had some rather odd experiences, I must say. For example, there was a very unfortunate episode when we entered the town of Gaza in March 1957, when the muezzin began calling the faithful to prayer. One of the Scandinavian soldiers believed this was an agitator calling the crowd to oppose the UN forces, and unfortunately opened fire, fortunately missed, on the muezzin in the minaret of the mosque. That took a lot of explaining. But that was a direct example of not having time to prepare soldiers for a world they were completely ignorant of. And I think it's a miracle we didn't have more of that. But I think I should say that soldiers, in my experience at any rate, welcome very much the unique challenge of being a UN soldier, where you cannot use your weapons as you've been trained to do, but you have to use your wits and your status as a person there to help everybody who's not fighting a war, taking sides. And we find that soldiers react extremely well to this, and on the whole, they like it.
Where are the soldiers taken from for the peacekeeping forces? How do they get on the peacekeeping forces?
Well, we started off with mostly more or less neutral countries like the Scandinavians in the original forces. That has expanded vastly because the demand for peacekeeping forces has greatly expanded. And I believe there are now some 53 countries which are or have provided forces for the UN. Maybe it's even more now. There is a major problem here of training, of indoctrination, of getting troops of the requisite standard of discipline and bearing to cope with what are very challenging jobs very often. And I think the UN has a long way to go on that. That's one of the many things that Boutros Ghali is now trying to do, to get a proper infrastructure in the UN which does training, logistics, contingency planning and so on. It's a big job.
I'm interested even in the nuts and bolts. Are the peacekeeping forces drawn from the armies of the participating
yes.
countries?
Yes, they are either regular or volunteer units according to the laws of the country concerned.
Now, I know I've heard some people say that, for instance, in some third world countries, it's a fairly common practice for soldiers or for the police to fire into crowds of demonstrators. And how can we expect them to behave differently if they're just moved from there to a peacekeeping force?
I would be very careful about confining that tendency to the third world. I can think of some extremely distressing examples of this much closer to home,
yeah.
including both American and British forces. So I think I wouldn't go along with the idea that this is a third world tendency. What we're talking about here is discipline and clear orders. And it's a difficult business to instill that very often in situations where the troops are very often outnumbered, faced with extremely threatening situations. But you can do it. I don't know how one's to account for what's been going on in Somalia, where it seems to me a degree of violence has been used, not just by third world troops, but also by, some first world forces, including Americans. I think that the essence of peacekeeping is that peacekeeping troops are above the situation and must remain above it if they're to be any use. If they descend into it by opening fire, they become part of the conflict and therefore part of the problem. And my experience is that's not a good idea. On the other hand, when you're dealing not with government armies, but who are under some kind of discipline, but with partisans, gangs, and so on, I think that there has to be an extremely disciplined and well-calculated capacity to actually use force to cut the cycle of violence before it gets out of control. And that's what I believe the UN now has to consider, and has to consider going forward from the peacekeeping idea to something slightly different for dealing with civil wars.
Brian Urquhart is former Undersecretary General of the United Nations. He's now a scholar in residence at the Ford Foundation. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Brian Urquhart will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our conversation with former United Nations Undersecretary General Brian Urquhart. He'll tell us how he became involved with the fledgling UN in 1945, and we'll hear what happened to him in World War II when he jumped from a plane and his parachute didn't open. Also, Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie, The Firm. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A White House official says that President Clinton will approve the military base closure list prepared by a federal commission. Nearly 30 major installations will be shut down and a dozen more realigned. NPR's Martha Raddatz has more.
The White House official, speaking on condition of anonymity, says the president has studied the base closure list and found it solid. The commission completed the list on Sunday after weeks of painful testimony across the country in communities affected by the closures. The cutback means the loss of jobs and federal money in those areas. The president has promised billions of dollars for cities and towns to convert military technology to civilian use and to train defense workers for new jobs. The Pentagon says the cutbacks will save over $3 billion per year, beginning in the year 2000. Once President Clinton approves the list and sends it to Congress, lawmakers have 45 working days to accept or reject the list in its entirety. The commission's recommendations will be adopted unless a resolution to disapprove clears both houses of Congress. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
In San Francisco, a gunman walked into a law firm in an office tower in San Francisco. Financial District in open fire this afternoon, and officials say at least 6 people have been wounded. Police say a floor-by-floor search of the skyscraper is now underway. The gunman is said to be armed with either a semi-automatic or an automatic weapon. As the president prepares for an economic summit meeting in Tokyo next week, administration officials are putting the best possible face on what is shaping up to be a very difficult meeting. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen issued a warning today. Don't expect any surprises from next week's meetings in Tokyo. The 7 leading industrialized nations are getting together to discuss ways to promote world economic growth, liberalize trade, and put together an assistance package for the former Soviet Union. The Treasury Secretary walked a fine line today between lowering expectations and suggesting that nothing much would come from the summit.
These things take time, and what you're seeing is policies that will be agreed to that we think will lead to growth and will create jobs, but it will not be overnight.
To achieve real results, President Clinton must convince his colleagues at the summit to take politically difficult steps, such as increasing their own budget deficits or risking higher inflation to promote growth. And that will be hard for all the other world leaders. Each is struggling with economies and approval ratings that are even worse than Mr. Clinton's. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Labor Department says the number of people filing new claims for jobless benefits dropped in the latest reporting period. The government says in the week ending June 26th, first-time claims fell by 11,000. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 5 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. President Clinton has announced a new plan to cut back on logging in the Pacific Northwest and provide nearly $1.5 billion in aid to the area. Trying to find a balance between jobs and the environment, Mr. Clinton said that he knows his plan may not make anyone happy, and indeed both sides have criticized it. Northwest environmentalists say the president's forestry plan is a great disappointment and has some serious flaws. Jennifer Schmidt of member station KPLU reports from Seattle.
Before bashing the plan, environmentalists praised President Clinton for courageously attempting to resolve the ancient forest controversy. But the environmental community expressed outrage at Clinton's failure to permanently protect the remaining 10% of the Pacific Northwest's old-growth forests. Clinton's plan permits some logging in old-growth stands, including thinning and salvage logging in reserves set aside for the endangered spotted owl. Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund attorney Todd True says he's skeptical the plan will work.
The ultimate measure of this plan is going to be whether it complies with the law. That's what we're going to be looking at, and right now we have some serious concerns with whether it does that.
Environmentalists say they will attempt to modify the forest plan once the administration presents it to a federal judge in Seattle later this month. For National Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Schmidt in Seattle.
The Conference Board says, according to its Index of Help Wanted Ads, advertising in May was up compared to the month before. The private business research group says its Help Wanted Index, using 1967 as a base of 100, increased by 5 percentage points in May. The board's latest survey indicated advertising for jobs was up in 7 regions of the nation over the last 3 months and down in 2 regions. A spokesman for the conference board says the troubled areas are in New England, the Middle Atlantic states, and along the West Coast. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross with the second part of our interview with Brian Urquhart. As former Undersecretary General of the United Nations, he directed peacekeeping forces in the Middle East and Cyprus. He was a UN Special Representative to the Congo. Now he says that the mission and guidelines of UN peacekeeping forces have to change to keep up with the changing nature of conflicts in the post-Cold War era. Urquhart has worked with the UN since its start. He was the personal assistant to the first Undersecretary General of the UN. You were in the group that created the first peacekeeping forces. Can we talk about some of the decisions that had to be made at the start? For instance, one of the, I guess, simpler decisions was how to identify that they were UN forces, what they should wear that would set them apart.
Well, there was a big problem about this because they had to be sent very urgently into Egypt to prevent something worse from happening. And some of the troops we were using, especially the Canadians, had exactly the same uniforms as the British Army, who, not unnaturally, were rather unpopular in Egypt, having just invaded it. And so the question was suitable headgear. We thought that blue berets would be the best thing, UN blue, which is a light and easily visible color. We then discovered, to our dismay, that there wasn't a sufficient supply of light blue berets in the world at that time, which we could get. So what we finally got was the plastic helmet liner of the U.S. combat helmet, of which there was a huge supply in Europe, and simply got those dipped in blue paint, and that's the way we identified the first troops. There was a big fuss, you won't believe this, at the beginning, about flying the U.N. flag. The soldiers, all being very proud of their different regiments, wishing to fly their national and regimental flags. Ralph Bunch, who was the great organizer of all this, insisted that the UN flag must be the flag of UN troops. There was quite a controversy about this, but it was a very important point because it identified these soldiers as being something different from the soldiers of imperial and colonial powers and others who'd been roaming the world for 2,000 years. It was a very important step forward. These things are all taken for granted now, but they all took quite a lot of argument at the beginning. And, of course, the whole business of building up a logistical setup from nothing for a group of soldiers who are going to a part of the world they're completely unused to is also quite a challenge.
Now, you came out of a military experience during World War II in the English Army. What were some of the differences for you between commanding in the army and overseeing peacekeeping forces? Did you have to have a totally different perspective?
Well, absolutely enormous difference, mm-hmm. Which is the question of the use of force. In my opinion, peacekeeping forces, and I say peacekeeping forces, not something else, should not use force except in self-defense. I actually presided over one of the exceptions in Katanga in the Congo in 1961 where we were authorized to use force. It created an enormous problem. The moment you open fire on the inhabitants or the soldiers of the place you're working in, you enter into a completely different relationship with those people who you're supposed to help. And I believe that it's important to preserve that characteristic of peacekeeping forces. But that does mean that the soldiers have a completely different, not only a different mandate, but a different way of doing things. And it does depend tremendously on the kind of political backing you can get, on the discipline and intelligence of quite junior commanders, like non-commissioned officers and junior officers.
Was there a time you had to give a talk to the troops about why, in spite of what was being done, they had to not use force?
Actually, it isn't the soldiers who are a problem on that. It's the officers. Uh-huh. The officers, for some reason, I suppose for reasons of bravado, love the idea of forceful means very often. And it's quite difficult to explain to them sometimes that it's a disaster. We had a lot of trouble with that in the Congo, where there was a military feeling that we should disarm the Congolese National Army. Well, the Congolese National Army was the army of the new independent state of the Congo, which we'd come to help, and it seemed a very odd thing to disarm its own army as our first effort to help them. I think that was a great mistake. What we tried to do was to retrain it. I think it's very important to explain to soldiers at all levels what it is they're doing, why they're doing it, why it's important, and why the people they're dealing with are so difficult. In the Middle East, for example, it's extremely important that soldiers should be aware of the history of the Middle East, of what has happened in the background of the Israelis, which makes them it can be extremely tough and sometimes very difficult, and what has happened in the background of the Arabs, and particularly the Palestinians, which makes them very difficult. These kind of things are necessary to explain to soldiers who are going to deal with them, and that applies to almost any place they go.
Can you share with us one of the most difficult predicaments you faced in your days of overseeing peacekeeping forces?
I personally found South Lebanon very difficult because we were pitchforked in there at about 2 hours' notice in total disregard of what those of us who knew about Lebanon and had been there a great deal said about it. And for, I think, completely bogus reasons. We were actually put into the Lebanon to save the Camp David talks, not with any regard to what the real problem in South Lebanon actually was. And we were dealing there with a territory in which the Israelis had invaded, were running their own version of a Lebanese army, and where you had no governmental authority from Lebanon at all, just a bunch of militias, PLO and other, more or less fighting the Israeli proxy army. This was an extremely difficult problem, not least because the governments, including the United States, who had been so keen on our getting in there, failed to give us any backing whatsoever once we got in and were sort of embarrassed by the whole thing. Well, they might be. I thought it was an outrageous performance myself, and I hope that no peacekeeping soldiers get into that again, though I think that they may. It is extremely important if the Security Council decides to send a peacekeeping force, that all its members actually back up those soldiers in the field once they're there, no matter how difficult the situation gets. And we didn't have that in Lebanon. It was, I thought, a very debilitating experience.
My guest is Brian Urquhart. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Brian Urquhart is my guest, former Undersecretary General of the United Nations. May I ask you about what I'm sure was a real crucial experience in your life, a real turning point? This was during World War II. You were in the airborne forces. You say you hated and dreaded jumping with a parachute, but it's something you had to do. And on one mission in August of 1942, the worst-case scenario happened. You jumped out of the plane and the parachute didn't open.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true. Well, it when I say it didn't open, it didn't open. It looked like a tulip bud, not a mushroom, and that doesn't help one very much coming down.
When did you realize you were in trouble?
Well, when I observed myself passing. The officer used to jump last in the British Army on the grounds that otherwise the men might refuse to get out of the plane. And when I found I was overtaking the men, I could easily see there was something wrong.
What did you think about on the way down?
Very little, because from 1,200 feet, it's really rather short. I thought how very incompetent the parachute packers were, if I thought about anything. Perhaps not in quite such polite terms as that.
Can I ask if you remember the moment of impact?
I suppose so, yes. I'm not sure I do, since I was knocked out. But no, I don't think I do, really.
Do you remember bracing for it?
Oh, yes. Well, we were all trained to do this kind of thing. We did a lot of exercises, jumping out of trucks, going at 40 miles an hour and things like that, which is supposed to toughen one up for this kind of thing, so that we were in good physical shape from that point of view.
So what were you trained to do if this happened?
Well, you were trained to keep your knees together and bend them slightly and try to absorb the shock. But, I mean, there isn't any training that actually compensates for a parachute failure. That's the plain fact of the matter. I mean, it's better not to land on your head. Let's put it that way. But I don't think there's too much you can do.
Is it pretty remarkable that you survived this?
It was thought so at the time, yes. I think I was lucky because I landed in a ploughed field. And I was fortunately very near to medical attention because this was a practice jump for a particularly disastrous operation, which was an operation to try to capture the town of Tunis by air, which actually went completely wrong. But we were on a training ground, and therefore there was medical attention very near, which isn't necessary in that kind of thing.
Did not many people survive this other mission that you were training for?
There were very heavy casualties.
Yeah.
It was a very disastrous mission.
Did you lose consciousness right away?
I think so. I don't really remember. Yes, I imagine I did, and then one sort of drifts in and out.
It's just amazing to me that you were able to recover and regain movement and. I guess what was broken?
Oh, goodness, a great number of things. I've both ankles, one thigh, one knee, four vertebrae in my back, and various other internal injuries. But I had very good medical attention. I was extremely lucky. Mm-hmm. I had a wonderful doctor. And also, I was young and very fit, which makes all the difference.
When you recovered, you went back into the military?
Yeah.
Why'd you want to go back?
Well, it's what I was very sad to be out of it. During the war, it seemed like the best thing to be in, really. And I'd been in it ever since I was 20 years old, so that I had no desire to leave it.
Did you ever have to command parachutists?
No. I wasn't allowed to jump after that anymore. I became a staff officer, where I got into endless trouble. So that.
Did you have nightmares about it afterwards?
No, absolutely not. Well, I don't like heights, but I never did like heights, so that, I don't think that's got anything to do with it, really.
Now, you were involved with the United Nations right from the very start. After World War II, how did you get involved with the UN?
Well, actually, funnily enough, I'd always wanted, when I was much younger, to work for the League of Nations, because I grew up in a family which devoted an enormous amount of time to the League of Nations and thought it was very important, as indeed I did. But, of course, by the time I got around to it, the war had come and the League had ceased to exist. So I was very anxious to work for its successor, the United Nations. And by pure luck, I managed to be taken on before it even came into being as the private secretary to a man called Gladwin Jebb, who was organizing the Preparatory Commission, which is the body which set the UN up in London. So I got into it that way. I was extremely lucky because it's what I really wanted to do.
Did you think it stood any chance of actually working at the very start?
Well, you know, at the beginning, it's very odd that the governments which had set the UN up, including the United States, believed that it would work pretty much as it was laid out to work in the Charter. And I find this very striking. I'd never really met any civilians when I joined the UN in my adult life. I'd been in the army for 6 years. And I was very surprised at this conviction that this absolutely new form of world order would absolutely work. And, of course, it actually didn't. It very soon broke up on Cold War lines. But what I did think was that it was absolutely indispensable to have this kind of organization, even if it didn't work very well. Because when things get bad enough, there is somewhere for everybody to come to get out of the disaster, something that didn't exist, incidentally, in 1914 when World War I started. There was no way that governments who were proud of themselves could go back on the situations they'd become committed to, whereas the UN provides for even the strongest governments to back away from disaster. And indeed, it provided the pretext for that to happen in a number of occasions, most notably the Cuban Missile Crisis, which I suppose was the most dangerous situation the human race has ever had to face. So that I think from that point of view, the existence of the UN is essential, even if it doesn't work very well. And of course, there was an excuse for it not working very well as long as the Cold War went on, when you couldn't get the Security Council to agree on anything.
How do you think the UN is functioning in the post-Cold War era?
Well, I think it's up against it, because I think it ought to work, but it's dealing with a whole series of situations it wasn't set up to deal with. And it's got to come to terms with that. It's got to develop its capacity. It's got to develop different ways of doing things, I think. And it's got to eventually, I think, to develop the capacity to deal with the real problems the human race is going to face, which are, as I said before, poverty, population, environment, degradation, and so on. And we are up against, I think, a very important deadline here. And as long as you have situations like Bosnia or Somalia or Cambodia or something distracting the attention of governments and people and the media, it's going to be very difficult to rally the resources and the concentration and the effort that is required to take a long, hard look at our economic and social situation in the world and decide what we're going to do about it. And those are the problems that are going to determine whether life on this planet is going to be worth living in another 60 or 70 years or so, not what happens in Bosnia. So I maintain that it's extremely important to get the peace and security, law and order side of the thing pinned down a bit so that we can get on to start considering the real problems.
Well, Brian Urquhart, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Not at all. It's my pleasure.
Brian Urquhart is former Undersecretary General of the United Nations. He's now a scholar in residence at the Ford Foundation. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton has revealed his plan on Northwest Timber. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
Well, we're taking a big position on Northwest Timber, Terry. We will we'll look at the plan. We'll have reaction from the Pacific Northwest. And then John Nielsen is going to talk about an experimental plan for trying to rebuild so-called old-growth forests. We also, this is also the day when the Base Closings Commission completes its work, and we will have a conversation with the chairman of the commission. We'll have more on the flooding in the Middle West and a new book on tuberculosis. The disease is coming back.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The star is Tom Cruise. The director is Sidney Pollack. The screenwriters include David Rabe and Robert Towne. And the book it's based on is John Grisham's bestseller, The Firm. Can this movie lose? Film critic Stephen Schiff went to find out.
At first, you just sit there and let the sheer professionalism of it all wash over you. The stars are lively and commanding. The supporting performances by people like Gene Hackman and Gary Busey and Holly Hunter and Ed Harris are all little gems. The screenwriting pulses, the direction gallops. Tom Cruise may still have the screen presence of an excitable Rice Krispie, but that's perfectly appropriate here. He plays Mitch McDeer, a poor kid who's become a hotshot at Harvard Law School and is now being wooed by the biggest firms in New York, Chicago, and L.A. Why he even bothers to show up for the interview with a small Memphis outfit called Bendini, Lambert, and Locke is hard to fathom. But then, these guys are unusually smooth. They set up a meeting in a suite at the Copley Plaza Hotel in Boston, and instead of letting Mitch just open the envelope and read their offer, they goad him into using his best courtroom manner on them. He cross-examines them into telling him what they propose.
Mr. McKnight, you are the managing partner at Bendini, Lambert, and Locke, is that correct?
Yes.
Did Mr. Lambert, as senior partner, give you any instructions regarding my employment?
He did.
And Mr. McKnight, do you usually follow Mr. Lambert's instructions?
Objection. Vague, ambiguous.
Sustained.
What precisely were those instructions?
That you were in great demand, and I should make certain that we obtain your services before a bidding situation developed.
How did you go about making certain?
I bribed a clerk in the Harvard Law Placement Office for the exact amount of the highest offer, and then added 20%.
That's clever screenwriting, and there's a lot of it in this movie, as Mitch and his wife, played by Gene Triplehorn, accept the firm's enticing offer and move to Memphis. Then the sinister stuff starts happening. The firm's partners have been dying in mysterious ways, and Bendini Lambert seems to want entirely too much control over its employees. Meanwhile, the FBI is looking into the firm's dirty dealings. They need a mole on the inside, and they've decided Mitch is their man. By now, the movie is coiling around Mitch like a python. Does he stay loyal to the firm and possibly follow his superiors to jail? Or does he go along with the FBI, get disbarred, and wind up in a witness protection program with his heart in his mouth every time he turns his ignition key? John Grisham's novel was a pretty clumsy piece of writing, but it took this plot and really made it move. It was essentially an 80s story about a greedy kid outwitting his greedy law firm, and the kid, in the end, took the money and ran to the ends of the earth. Grisham's book was vulgar and nasty, not brainy or refined, but juicy. The movie, meanwhile, is brainy and refined, but a lot of the juice is gone. The screenwriters have reworked the plot so that McDear might just manage to win and keep his integrity as a lawyer, too. It's a 90s approach grafted onto an 80s premise, and the hybrid never quite takes root in your imagination. Pollock's expert chase scene seems strangely out of sync with the delicate legalisms of Mitch's big scheme. And by the time you walk out of the movie, a hefty 2.5 hours later, you feel you've just watched a giant chess game, only with lots of running. The firm is an unusual case. How often do you see a Hollywood movie that's too good for its own good?
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein, Nancy Greenlease, and Robbie Harris. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we start the holiday weekend off with two favorite interviews from our archives. We'll hear from the master of funk, George Clinton, and from the great comic writer and director, Mel Brooks. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.